Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening, and thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight and listening to us jabber at each other. My guest tonight is Mare Cromwell, who's been on before, and we're going to be talking about her first book, which is If I Gave You God's Phone Number. A fascinating premise. So we will get together with Mare in a couple of minutes, but first tonight's metaphysical musing. And this is a very special day of the year for me. It's my father's birthday. My father was still alive. He would be 107 years old, and he was an important person in more ways than perhaps for other kids. For me, because he was one of the few trustworthy people in my family, and a family I, in looking back, consider pretty crazy. And I think about his lifetime and what went on for him. He came, as they say, came over on the boat as a Eastern European Jewish immigrant coming over as a child to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which was the neighborhood where all the people from that area of the world were settling, a little Jewish community on the Lower East Side. And at that point in time, there really were no cars. It was horse-drawn carriages and carts for people selling things, or push carts, you know, people pushing a wagon, human-powered. There were no electric lights. It was gas lights in the apartments, and it was probably a fourth-floor walk-up tenement apartment. There was indoor plumbing, but I'm not sure there was hot water. There was no refrigeration, partly because there was no electricity available, but also because that really wasn't developed until later. So they had ice boxes, and there were people that brought large blocks of ice on a wagon and would carry them up the three or four flights of stairs to your apartment. And there was something that looked sort of like a small refrigerator, but basically it was a cooler. There was a place in the top to put the ice. And that would keep whatever you kept in the insulated box cool. There was no radio, certainly no television yet. There were no airplanes. Railroad was the way that people got around, or ships across the ocean. And in his lifetime, he watched all of that unfold. Electricity, telephone, radio, television, refrigeration, cars, airplanes, all of it in one lifetime. And he was working on computers by the time those showed up as well. What an extraordinary period of time, and what an extraordinary thing to go through. As you know, he was just a guy. There was World War II was in there, which was also quite an experience to go through. And I, as soon as he got back, they had me, and then there was family life. But what an amazing thing! He also, as a young man during the Depression, there really was no work. And one of the programs FDR created was the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which took strapping young lads from the cities and took them out basically into the wilderness to do things like lumberjack the trees in what would be the national parks and create the fire roads so that they actually could get in there and build the structures so that they could be used as national parks. So he did that, and when he was done with that, he was a hobo. and he went from place to place hitching rides on freight trains looking for work. Just, he had a pretty amazing life. And we think of all those stories and folk songs and folk tales, and he did that. He did that. And he also was my buddy. He was the one that I could always depend on. So Max, he was always called Mac, but his name was Max. Thank you. And I miss you. Happy birthday. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And let's have some fun with Mayor Cromwell. Hey, Mayor. Thanks so much for being on the show again.
Hey, David. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think you're my favorite interviewer.
Well, thank you. That's very nice to hear. You've written several books, but we had not talked about your first book, and the premise of the book is absolutely fascinating. And I get a lot of books and I don't read all of them. And this is one that I will definitely finish because I'm really enjoying it. And wow. The title is, If I Gave You God's Phone Number, Searching for Spirituality in America. And you interviewed a really wide range of people starting out with that question. What would you do if I gave you God's phone number? And it's just, it leads so many interesting places.
yes, it definitely did. It's interview. The book took me 7 years to write, and over those 7 years, like 7.5 years actually, I interviewed 49 people, and 21 people made it into the book. Some of the interviews were a little bit repetitive, so the ones that really rose to the surface mm-hmm. are the ones in there. And yeah, I really had no idea what people were going to say when I would ask them the question, if I gave you God's phone number, what would you do with that? So they just went in all sorts of fascinating places. And the people listening right now on your show are probably wondering, well, how did I find these people to interview? And the way I found them, I should first start out by saying that the whole reason the book manifested was it started off with it being Father's Day in 1995. And I was living with an elderly woman. And on her way to church that morning, and we got to be really good friends. I was basically renting a room from her. I'd grown up with her kids and all that. And I was back from doing international work, trying to figure out my life and living simply. And so on her way to church that Sunday morning, Father's Day, she said, don't forget to call your father. And I just immediately went to this place of, wow, can you imagine if you could call God the Father? That would be really amazing. And I was raised Catholic, so this sort of God the Father persona or image was still in my mind very prominently at that time. And then I thought, what a great question to ask people. What would they do if they had God's phone number, if they could call God? And the idea would not go away. And I think a lot of us know that when an idea surfaces and it won't leave you, you need to actually follow through on it. If you're really following your soul path, I guess I would word it that way. So I ended up getting a tape recorder about 2 months into this question that wouldn't go away in my brain to start interviewing. It was like people within arm's reach at first. It was the friends of the elderly woman where I was living. And I think they were a little bit shocked at this young woman living with their elderly friend, asking them about God's phone number. But, you know, they were open to it. And then I interviewed children of friends. And then after I'd done about 6 or 7 interviews, I realized that there was something going on here that was very fascinating because it was not my intent to write a book. I never thought I'd write a book. I just had this goofy idea and I was interviewing people. And that's when I realized that this really was a book and needed to be as wide, a diverse set of people as possible that I was seeking out. So then the adventure started from there.
Well, I love that the first two people that you interview that are the first two chapters in the book, man, and how, where they were in the sequence of interviews, were two kids.
Yeah.
A brother and sister. And,
yeah.
And they had fascinating insights.
They really did. You know, they were very bright children. And the boy, I think he was all of 10 at the time. I mean, the kinds of questions he was asking that he would want to ask God were deeply profound. I mean, I think just kind of spoke to his intellect. I do remember, like, I have notes here on some of the questions that he asked. Because every interview started, you know, with the question, if I gave you God's phone number, what would you do with it? And so with him and his sister, they both said they would call. And then I would say, well, once you got God on the phone, what would you want to ask or what would you want to say? So one of his questions was, what does God do with all the people who do not follow his path of life?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which you know, different religions teach about, but he wanted to know what God would really say as opposed to what he had been learning at Sunday school. And right. Then another question that he asked was, is it God or Satan who gives us such strong faults such as anger, jealousy, or greed? You know, and again, different religions will give the answer, will provide the answer. But he was profound. He was an amazing interview. It was fun. It was really fun.
And then you went to the totally opposite end of the age spectrum, and you interviewed folks in their 80s.
Yeah, well, those were the ones who were the friends of the lady I was living with. They were the ones within arm's reach.
Right.
The kids were children of a friend of mine, some friends of mine that I happened to, you know, be visiting, and I had just gotten the tape recorder. So there is a bit of a, the order in the book is pretty close to the order in which I interviewed them. And then there were people that aren't in the book that I interviewed too. Yeah, the next man was 82 years old, and he didn't believe in God. He was definitely an atheist, so that challenged me. And there are a couple people in the book who don't believe or didn't believe at that time. And, you know, that was challenging because I really wanted them to engage with the question and have something they would want to talk with God about. And so the conversations with people like him went to the place of, well, how is it that you arrived at this place of not believing in a God? And they had really good reasons why they didn't believe, the ones who were agnostics or atheists. Yeah, he was a tough interview, though, actually. I have to say that I'm very sensitive to energy, and I remember still, and this has been more than 20 years since I interviewed him, because I started the process in 1995, that the energy in the space where we were talking as he was talking toward the end started to really creep me out. You know? So whatever was going on there, I forget what he said. I'm trying to look at the notes here right now. But he, he was tough. But he had some good points. He had some good reasons why he didn't believe. You know, he was raised Catholic, and he just felt like it was, you know, a lot of hogwash, basically.
Well, you know, that's actually a fascinating line in the sand, basically, between organized religion with a very staunch, you know, the Catholic Church being the one that we in this culture know the best. They have their understanding and their story and their position on everything. And if you disagree with it, you're a heretic.
You're labeled very fast.
And throughout history, they were not very kind to heretics.
they lost their lives.
But the, you know, if the only choice is that, and you look at it and go, wait a minute, that's, you know, even if you go to a place of that's not quite right, I have questions they won't answer. then you move in the direction of, well, what else? Mm-hmm. And that could be another religion, that could be a spiritual path, mm-hmm. could be any number of things. But in many ways, being an agnostic is the most honest spiritual path there is. Agnostic means, I don't know. I don't know. I have questions. I have all these things I've been told, and none of it can be proved, and none of it seems quite right, and I'm just sitting here with the questions. And that's really a fascinating, honest and powerful thing to be able to do in a culture that wants you to take a position one way or another. Make your choice. We want to be able to say whether you're right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from someone who states that they're an atheist, where they're saying there is no God. I am taking a position that not only is your explanation not something that resonates for me, but there is no God. And that's not what agnostics do. Agnostics sit there and watch all of it and go, I don't know.
Yeah, it's beautiful to have the openness. This particular 82-year-old man, I think he was at the place where he just felt like, you know, there's no God. And I remember, I mean, I asked him whether, you know, would he be tempted to pull the number out and maybe look at it at least? And his response was, I don't think so. And then he said, I'm not afraid of dying. I think fear of dying is why most people will want to try to communicate with God, but I would not use the number. I really did wonder, and I know the man's not alive right now, I really did wonder if on his grave, on his dying moments, in his dying moments, whether at that, in those moments, he had a shift, that maybe he was more open, maybe he, you know, wanted to reach out to something beyond him that he believed didn't exist at all for a long time.
Right.
Because I know that for every person that I interviewed, what I was doing was just capturing this tiny snapshot of where they were in that moment. Because people are pretty much always shifting, unless they're, you know, really hardcore, like this is the way it is and I'm not shifting at all. But I think even then, when they're on their dying bed, things open up a little.
And lots of people have an experience of seeing across to the other side, however they experience that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that is a fascinating conversation to think about is none of the stories describing heaven are accurate. I have yet to hear a single tradition that gets it the way that mystics explain what it is.
Mm.
The people who can shift their consciousness and go to that level of vibration. Mm-hmm. And so if you believe that the streets are paved with gold and there's going to be an archway with St. Peter there and there's going to be angels playing harps and you die and that's not what it is, it's complicated. Am I in heaven? Am I in hell? The story doesn't fit. What am I looking at here? Because there are a lot, and you know, each tradition has their own version. There are very vivid, this is the way it is in heaven.
Yeah, and it's also sad. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
You know, and then you wind up with the cognitive dissonance of no longer being in your body and not seeing what you were told you were going to see.
Hopefully there's some spiritual being there that will explain to you. Listen, let's set it straight here. You know, what you were taught is not necessarily the way it is here over in the spiritual realms. It's okay, though. Can you feel the love?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully the love they experience will be like, okay, yeah, I got the love. But what makes me sad is from what I understand now, where I sit, spiritually, is that there are a good number of people who were raised in the dogma of the fire and brimstone, and when they die, they're too afraid to fully pass over because they
right.
they're concerned they're going to be in hell burning. So they're stuck over here. And
right. And that's because of all the sins they've been told they have committed, because being human is sinful. You know, there's this whole list of very human things that you're not supposed to do.
Yep.
And yeah, I've seen that helping ghosts to cross over. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I think it's one of the terrible things that gets done to people is that definition of everything being sinful. And, you know, I've been at cemeteries where there's a whole bunch of guys hanging out together. And what are you guys doing here? Obviously, you know, you're dead. Yeah, but we've been drinking and carousing and chasing women our whole lives, and we know where we're going. So we'll just stay here.
Yeah.
It's like the pub.
Uh-huh. But from what I understand, you know, it's very painful for them to be stuck here too.
Right,
and I can see,
right.
You know, because you interviewed me before about Mother Gaia and my rapport with her, and Mother Gaia doesn't want them here. You know, they're not supposed
right.
to be here.
Right. So it's but, helpful you know, a few seconds of connecting them to the heart of God and the love of God and feeling that they are loved. And they're like, yeah, I'll go there.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're out of there.
Yeah, beautiful.
So, and there's lots of ways to do that. Everybody I know that does that psychopomp process of helping a ghost cross over does it slightly differently, but it's all basically that same idea. First, making sure they know they're dead, because most ghosts mm-hmm. don't know they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
But if they do know, connecting them to the power of love in the universe and telling them that they're loved and they need to go home.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, David, when I was doing this book, I didn't interview any ghosts.
Good.
That was not on my radar at that time, to go hang out in a cemetery or some place where it was haunted. I pull out a tape recorder and try to talk to them. So what would you do if you had God's cell number? I'm not sure. God might send me to hell. No, let me set you straight here.
totally different set of questions and circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the question that you asked came up with such a beautiful wide range of conversations and insights that typically nobody has.
Well, and that's a really good point, is I was encouraging people to open up these deep, deep inner beliefs and views about God and spirituality. And a number of the people I interviewed said to me, nobody knows this. I never talk about this. As a matter of fact, a lot of, more than half the people in the book, that's not their real name in the book, because I wanted them to feel very comfortable speaking their truth. And they were afraid they would offend people. And some of the things some people said were kind of, would be considered offensive, you know, to other people.
Sure.
So, but yeah, I was able to, you know, it's really fun to do interviews. It's really fun to just sit down.
I know.
And here we are, you know, here we are live. But to sit down with them and encourage them to feel so safe that they bare their soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great time doing it. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was just doing it. And I think, you know, as an empath, my sensitivities of tuning into their energy and reading their body language and all that, I was able to really draw out some very deep truths.
Ask the right questions.
Which were hidden. Yeah, that were hidden inside them. Because this whole thing about speaking about your religion or your spiritual beliefs, we don't do most times.
Yeah, we're gonna have to go to the break. I want to make sure people know where to find you online. What's your website?
It's marecromwell.com, marecromwell.com. Yeah. And the book is If I Gave You God's Phone Number. It's on Amazon, Kindle, all that.
Right. And it won several awards, which is amazing for a first book. So again, yeah. the title the title is, If I Gave You God's Phone Number, Searching for Spirituality in America. So we are going to be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller, with my guest, Mayor Cromwell. And this is David Franklin Farkas on the Farkas Files. This is Empower Radio, and don't go nowhere. We'll be right back, and we'll have more fun.
Meditation channel, nonstop meditation music 24 hours a day in the new Empower Radio app. Music to empower your meditation, help you relax, sleep, or provide a calm background while you work. The Empower Meditation channel is interruption free. Listen now with the Empower Radio app, free in the App Store, or listen online at empower.fm. Soothe your soul, calm your mind. The Empower Meditation channel.
This is a test to find out if you know it all when it comes to children. Time starts now. Name one of the leading killers of U.S. children age 1 to 13. What's the best way to protect children in a car crash? At what age and size should a child start using a booster seat? Where can you find the answers to these questions?
Car crashes are one of the leading killers of U.S. children. Many of those deaths could be prevented by making sure that kids are in the right seat for their age and size. Don't assume you know it all when it comes to car seats for your child. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat and know for sure. That's safercar.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better. And kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
All in together now. We can make it better now. Come on, can we do it?
We know that we can.
We're open up.
Cause we know how to jump.
We'll roll it out. Roll it out.
We know how to skate.
We'll cut it down.
Cut it down. We know what to eat.
We'll swap it out.
We eat healthy stuff.
Just moving a little and eating better every day can help make you and your kids healthier. Search We Can online to find doable tips and activities that you can use every day. That's We Can. A message from the Ad Council, HHS, and NIH's We Can program.
Empower your life. Empower Radio.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my wonderful guest, Mayor Cromwell. Well, we're talking about her book, If I Gave You God's Phone Number, which is just a fantastic premise.
Thank you.
So tell me another interview, another situation that really sticks with you, something that you didn't expect.
Well, you know, I thought that I had gotten all the interviews I needed for the book, and then 9/11 happened in 2001, and And at the time, I realized I thought I was wrapping up how to put all the book together, all the pieces of it, you know, the different chapters. And then I realized that I didn't have anyone I'd interviewed who was Muslim. And a friend of mine who is affiliated with a Sufi community in Philadelphia connected me with a man from Afghanistan originally, who was a resident of the Sufi community. And this is a beautiful, beautiful spiritual man. And it was such a rich interview. He's one of the people who, first of all, his life story was powerful because he grew up in Kabul. And the U.S. Wow. was actually bombing Kabul at the time that I was interviewing him. It was just pretty dramatic. But he's one of these people that once I asked him the question, he shifted and energetically went into the spiritual space where I asked him after him responding to maybe the first two questions in the interview, I said, you already have God's phone number, don't you? And he said, well, you know, most of the time, sometimes not. And I, and then he said that the times he doesn't is when he's working on the computer. But he's a mystic. He, you know, he was brought over from Kabul. He was, what is it called, when the government brings you an exile, a refugee. And at that time, obviously, we didn't have the same president we have now. He and his brothers were brought over because their family was pretty influential in Afghanistan, and the Russians were invading, and so they were given refugee status. But he was already having spiritual experiences, connecting with God and yearning for his spiritual teacher. And he started like having visions, if I remember correctly, visions of what his spiritual teacher looked like, a Sufi master. And so he finally found this teacher who was originally from Sri Lanka, who had set up a Sufi community in Philadelphia. And he was what you call the Mujahideen. He was the man in the community who called everyone into prayer five times a day. And so while I was interviewing him, he kept on checking his clock, his watch, and said, oh, now I need to go, I need to go. And so he had to go around the big, huge house that had been converted. And he went around and he did the call that he does. I think I can't remember how he did it. I guess he sang it. And he said to me that I could stay for the prayers. So I was guided by another woman who lived there, and everything I needed to do, like wash my feet, wash my hands, take my shoes off. But he was such a beautiful man and just touched me deeply, deeply, the amount of, you know, divine energy that he was tapped into. And I'll never forget that interview. It was just, I didn't want it to end because his interview was one of the few where I felt like God was really with us. The divine energy in the space while we were talking and I was encouraging him to share was just so spiritual.
And it's fascinating. So few Americans anyway, know about the Sufi corner of the Muslim religion.
Yeah.
And it's all about love and all about spirituality. And if that's what you've touched in the Islamic world, you can't even make sense out of the violence.
Not at all. It's a whole different universe. And granted, you know, I didn't seek out someone Islamic who was angry, you know, or in a different sort of path within the Islamic tradition. I mean, the Sufis are beautiful, beautiful. I mean, they're all beautiful. Every person's beautiful. But to be able to sit down with a mystic like this man and be in his presence was truly a gift.
Yeah, yeah. I've met several Sufis, and they were extraordinary people. Extraordinary people.
Yeah, yeah. And if anyone who's listening doesn't know of Rumi, go seek out Rumi's poetry, because he was a mystic in the Sufi tradition, R-U-M-I.
Right.
And there's some beautiful translations of his spiritual poetry. It's just deep, really deep. But I'd love to share about another person.
Oh, sure.
Sorry. Because another person that I interviewed, which was a lot of work getting this interview, was a death row inmate in the Supermax facility in downtown Baltimore. And when I was, you know, in the process of collecting these different interviews, I was determined to find someone who was in prison to interview them. And I didn't have anybody that I knew personally who was in prison.
Right.
And at the time, I forget what month it was, what year even, because the book took a number of years to write, and the interview process was a couple years long. But there was an article in the Sun Papers in Baltimore, and I'm from Baltimore, and I was living in Baltimore at the time. And there was this article about the death row population and whether it was correct or ethical or right for them to have access to computers to research their legal cases and whatever else they did on the computers. And so I called the journalist up and I said, "Hi, I'm this writer and I'm working on a book and I'd love to interview someone in prison. And can you suggest someone that I could reach out to?" And he said, "Well, why don't you write to one of the people in my article that I interview?" And I said, "Well, I'm feeling kind of drawn to this one man." He says, "Well, I think that would be a good person, you know, because he seemed pretty open." And when I talked to him, and so one thing led to another, and I ended up writing, I wrote a letter to this man in the Supermax facility, and we wrote back and forth about, I guess, 6 or 7 times, and I told him about the book, and I'm trying to remember how many times we wrote. I don't exactly remember. It was a number of years ago. But then I had to go and meet him, because he said, "Well, I really don't want an interview with you if I can't meet you in person." A person being on the other side of the thick glass walls there in the, right. in the prison. But I had to go, and I went, I think it was 5 times to meet with him, to get to know him better. And that was a trip, because if you haven't spent time in a prison visiting someone, it's an experience. I mean, they check all of you, you know, they want to make sure that you don't have any weapons and all that, and just getting the permission for me to go and visit him. I mean, we had to pull some strings to get the right paperwork shuffled from the right desk to the wrong desk to the right desk. But then when the interview actually happened, I couldn't take a tape recorder into the prison. So we did it over the phone, and then I was able to record it over the phone. But it was kind of interesting meeting this man and listening to his story. Because he was adamant that he was innocent, that he hadn't killed the man that he was convicted of killing, and he was up for death row. And by the way, Maryland has revoked the death penalty, so he's still there in prison, from what I understand. We have not stayed in touch. But he had some really good questions about how is it that his minister, where he used to go to church in Maryland, how come that man had so much money, like multiple houses and all these different cars? Just odd to him.
Right.
Like, good question. I wonder how many people challenge their ministers who become rather affluent. But this man, he's actually, I think his real name's in the book. He didn't really care about changing his name. He really was adamant that he was innocent. And yet at the same time, and when I was talking to him one of the visits in there, I could tell that there was something missing. There was some ethical baseline of truth that was just not apparent, and it just made me wonder.
Right.
Of course, most people say they're innocent when they're not. But I'll never forget that he told me the story about how he had gotten not the odometer, but the speed gauge on his dashboard didn't work, and he got 7 tickets in one day, and he was adamant that it was the police fault. It wasn't his fault that his dashboard didn't work with the speed gauge. It was the police fault. I was like, "That's a little off here."
Yeah, cause and effect.
Yeah. Like, can we take responsibility? Yeah. So he was. It was a real interesting experience just getting that interview, and Oh, another interesting story about him was that he was quite a charmer. And apparently when he was arrested and the court proceedings started, he was dating 5 or 6 women at the same time. And none of them knew about the others. So they were pretty pissed off when they all arrived in court to support him. But then he was, you know, convicted and in prison. And then he had had 3 marriage proposals from different women that like to go and befriend and write letters with men in prison. 3 women wanted
with
to marry.
People on death row.
Yeah.
On death people row. On death row. That's a fairly common thing. And I certainly don't understand that.
No, I don't either. But he was very charming. I mean, I could feel him like trying to work me a little. And I'm going, whoa, I don't think so.
Sounds like a sociopath.
Yeah. But that was it. I had to work really hard for that interview. Right. It was worth it, though. It was really worth it. Very interesting. You know, some of the questions he asked were really spot on because it was about organized religion. And, you know, again, some of the greed of some of the pastors. And that was an interesting interview.
Yeah, the closest I've gotten to a supermax prison is my neighbor retired a couple of years ago from 22 years as a corrections officer at a supermax. And he wouldn't share much. I got a little bit from him, but he wouldn't share much. He didn't want to tell anybody about what it was like.
Yeah, it's not a very positive place, that's for sure.
No.
I'm not in any rush to go back.
Right. As he became the guy who had been there forever, they let him be the guy who drove around the perimeter in the truck, making sure nobody escaped. So he wasn't inside messing with the inmates all day. That was a big relief.
That would be an easier position.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I've got the book open to me in front of me. And one of the questions that I asked him was, he was talking about how he already feels like he's mostly dead just being in prison. And he talked about how that he would look forward to being a ghost and not dying and passing over. Because in his mind, it would be more amusing. And then people would never forget him. Because he feels very forgotten.
Yeah, people have such interesting ideas about what it means to be a ghost.
Yeah, they do. They do. But, you know, I mean, he did help me understand that, you know, if you are in prison, you really, there's a huge aspect of you that it's already dead. You know,
right.
It's so shut down. And he felt very lonely, you know. People don't visit, they don't call. So, very hard. And maybe he deserved it. I don't know. Who am I to say that? But that was a pretty interesting interview with him.
That, well, it took a lot of courage to set that up and go in and out of the prison. So, that's quite an experience.
I can be pretty determined.
Yeah, I got that.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I just knew I needed someone who was already incarcerated because I just thought, what an interesting, you know, set of questions to ask them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what was your answer to the question?
Well, when I first started the book, I was actually dealing with a lot of depression. Trying to figure out my life. I mean, I'd been doing international work, had a great job, and just left it because I was on and off antidepressants, and I wanted to heal, and I just was spiritually, you know, my inner guidance was, you're not going to get another full-time, busy job, workaholic job. And so when I first started with the interviews, I would love to have been able to talk to God. And I imagine, you know, I guess my questions at the time would have been, how can I heal? You know, how can I recover from this depression? But because it was such a long process of time in the time span of, you know, going out and getting all the interviews, it was 7 years, I started studying with a Cherokee medicine woman about halfway through those 7 years. And she was a very gifted healer. And so my sense of God and my sense of Earth Mother, Mother Gaia, started to really shift. And this is a woman, actually her interview is the last one in the book. She is in the book. And she talks in her interview about how she's talking to God and Earth Mother all the time and how they laugh at her when she's being silly and, you know, how their voices are different. And so I had a really different sense of creator or God by the time I finished the interview process and was putting all the interviews together into the book. And I know that I didn't really feel the need to have God's phone number toward the end of the process. But having said that, what I also arrived at in the process of doing the interviews and also then starting to study with the Cherokee teacher is that we each actually already have God's phone number within ourselves. Within each of us is that seed of being a mystic. Being able to listen and communicate with spirit. And people, someone might say, well, you're talking about spirit now, you're not talking about God. For a lot of people, it's the same, you know, unless you're incredibly discerning and you know exactly who you're talking to and it is God or it is, you know, the tree over there that's talking with you, or because the mystics will, you know, can talk with all sorts of different beings. I mean, one of my spiritual gifts and my soul work is I communicate with Mother Gaia. So she's talking with me. I'm not talking to God. I'm pretty certain of that. But I don't feel the need to now because I feel like I've got most of the answers that I need. And I've also learned that if I don't have the answer in the moment, that it will come to me. When I need it. I really came to trust that. So I didn't need to search out this deity out there in the universe, the man in the sky with the beard, as I was taught to think about God as a young Catholic girl. I didn't need that, you know. And the good news is that Mother Gaia will give me some good answers at times. Or she'll gently guide me in a certain direction. Yeah. And then be like, well, okay, you figure it out from there. but this is a suggestion right now.
I'm going to drop you off on this street corner and see what you do.
Yeah, right. Remember, you have all the tools to figure out how to get home. So just click your heels 3 times. Don't forget the ruby slippers.
Right.
Yeah. But it was, you know, really interesting how many of the various people I interviewed, some people they leapt into the opportunity to think about calling God on the phone and they immediately would make the call. And then others who I interviewed were like, well, I think I'd think about it, you know, or I'd put it on my bureau and look at it for a couple of days. And then there were those who would be like, I would put it on every bathroom wall that I ever went in because I want the whole world to have it. Really? Yeah, there were people who said
for a good time call.
Right, for a good time call, God. Here's the number. But I do think we all have the number. I really, really do. And it's cultivating it. It's learning how to create that inner stillness. And also being very discerning. Because sometimes spirit will come in and want to talk to you, and they're not necessarily serving the highest good. Because we know about people like the Son of Sam and those who hear voices and then go get a, you know, AK-47 or whatever they got.
Well, and also, in order to let that in, you have to think, have to allow yourself to feel worthy. God won't talk to me. You know, I don't deserve that.
And you know, that was one of the things one of the people said in my interviews. She was an African-American woman, and when she, you know, was guided by her mother to go to this apostolic church, you know, her first thought was, I'm not worthy of God's love here. And then she started learning how to speak in tongues, which kind of still blows my mind. I don't know what people are doing when they speak in tongues, but I know they're in a very deep spiritual place. But she did not feel worthy. She did not feel that she was worthy of learning how to speak in tongues. And
just as a total aside, I once had a girlfriend who spoke in tongues when she was angry at me.
Really? Is that a joke or is this for real?
No, I'm not kidding.
So what was she saying? Do you know?
Even she didn't know, because she would go off into whatever state it was that came through. She knew how she felt about it, but she had no idea what she said.
That is so interesting.
Kind of
okay. All right. Well, that's a whole other interview.
Yeah.
Mm. It was also, I want to say this, I think people might expect this to some degree, but some of the people I interviewed were very, very religious.
Sure.
And so their dogma and what they had been taught in their churches, like one woman said, well, we're taught in church, you don't question God. So she had no questions. But she did want to talk about how much gratitude she had for God. And then this is actually a woman that I grew up with. She was our maid growing up. And then she wanted to talk about how God has a plan for me, Mayor. We got off on God's plan. Like, God has a plan that Mayor will find the right husband, because I hadn't found the right husband yet at that point. Still haven't, but never mind that. I tried to explain to her that maybe God's plan doesn't mean that I'm going to have a husband. I mean, there's a possibility there, but she's like, oh, God has a plan for you. God has a plan for your brother, too, and he's not married yet. Amazing.
Well, this is so much fun that, of course, we're running out of time. So again, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and this was great fun. My guest tonight is Mayor Cromwell. We're talking about her first book, If I Gave You God's Phone Number, which is available all the places that you can get books, Amazon and all the other places. Wonderful award-winning book, and I encourage you to check it out. So, and give them your website again.
Yes. So my website is mayorcromwell.com. If you want an autographed copy from the author, I can mail it to you. Order it there and I will autograph it for you and mail it. And you can also explore my other books and my other events there. I'm kind of a busy person like all of us these days. But this has been really fun, David. It's such a great time to be with you on air like this.
Well, thank you so much. It's, we have a good time, and that makes it a good time for everybody else. And you're just so much fun to talk to. So thank you for coming on the show again. My guest tonight has been Mayor Cromwell, and her book again is If I Gave You God's Phone Number. Thanks, Mayor. And if you've gotten at all curious about who is this guy David and what in the world does he do, you can go to househealing.com, and there's every technology to connect with me, including a link to schedule a telephone appointment for 20 minutes or so, and we'll talk about whatever's going on with the person, place, situation, business, whatever it might be, see how my work might be useful to you. If you want more about the show, it's Cleverly Hiding in Plain View at thefarkasfiles.com. And you can find the archive of all the shows going back to the beginning of time, which is about 6 years now, hundreds of interviews. But the easiest way to listen to the show now is to get the Empower Radio app, and then you can just click on my show and see the whole archive. But you can also look at all the other shows. Empower Radio has 24/7 uplifting programming, so check it out. We're also on almost every streaming media outlet: iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or iTunes Podcasts. Tune in, and so you can find Empower Radio and the Farkas Files all over the place. And thank you so much for hanging out with us, because otherwise I'm just sitting here by myself talking into a microphone, and that's pretty silly. So I hope you, wherever you are and whenever you are listening, because there are so many ways to listen, that you enjoy your time with us. Because I certainly enjoy doing this. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas File. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week.